why do pension funds have to think about impact investing only for like 0.5%, 1% of their entire asset allocation? This is wrong. This is not a right way to think in a time of like the existential challenges that we're facing. So I cannot tell you whether like the overall estimate is right or wrong. I think that like the methodology underpinning such estimate is sound enough. But the key is that like I'm definitely in favor of having impact investing transforming itself from like a niche asset class in its own to a systematic investment approach that can be applied across any kind of investment strategy.
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show that plugs into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm excited today to pick up a topic that I think needs a lot of air and attention, which is the topic of sustainable investing, but in a new kind of world and a new setting. It's kind of a world that, in a way, coming out of the conversation that I had with Dario Mangilli, who's the guest today, would almost be a sustainable investment in a disaster economy, in the sense that we met up at a conference in Milan, actually, and we started talking about what it meant to be an investor today in a world which is being faced increasingly with climate impacts, but also in a post-ESG backlash world. And I really enjoyed the conversation we had, and I thought that instead of being a little bit selfish and keeping it all for myself, we could actually take this conversation forward and share it with a broader audience. So I'm really excited to have Dario on the show. Dario, it's really nice to have you on board.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Looking forward to this discussion.
Before we jump in and open the box of those thinking in that conversation, I thought it'd be useful for the audience to get a little bit of a background of yourself. So what's your journey into kind of sustainable investments? How did you get here? How did you end up joining this broader sector and really maybe cover slightly what Impact SGR is, the firm you work with, and how did that fall in?
Yeah, sure. Like, starts from the most recent developments, in the sense that I'm the head of sustainability at the Impact SGR. We are a Milan-based investment management company focused on listed impact investing. So our positioning has been, since the beginning, since inception, to try to fit impact investing into the listed equity and listed fixed income world, which obviously is different with respect to what you usually do in a venture capital or private equity. We thought there was a huge need also to have this kind of like space being filled in the listed equity and listed bond space. Obviously, the way in which you do that is different. You need to still transpose the key elements of impact investing, specific intentionality and measurability, in order to design investment products that can intentionally and measurably pursue specific impact objectives in the investment strategies. So I lead a team of impact research analysts right now. I've been dealing with sustainability, I think, since beginning, basically, in the sense that I understood that sustainability as a structural driver of the world economy. I wanted it to be my key priority since when I started studying climate change. Specifically, I had my bachelor in international economics, and then I had double degree between Sciences Po and the London School of Economics. And back in the days, it's been a while now. What I studied is like international economic policy, international political economy with a thematic concentration in international energy. So international energy, I specifically focused on low carbon scenarios and renewable energy sources. So when I've started dealing with the low carbon scenarios and the scenarios we were heading into, which is, by the way, much worse right now, I said, okay, I think that this is what I really want to deal with from different angles. And I've been doing so from different angles across like over the last 10 years. The pivotal moment when I started studying low carbon scenarios and I realized the direction of travel was pretty pretty off. So I wanted to make it a bit more right.
Okay. All right. So early on, basically in your career, already an academic, you started to see the value of sustainability and climate, probably. And then this brought you to where you are today. You mentioned that you guys are looking at impact investing in listed equity. Now, I would argue that that's not where people typically think of impact investments. I would argue that the two cliches of impact investments are, one, it's in the private markets. And, you know, sometimes cliche have some kernel of truth. A recent Gin report says that of the 1.6 trillion AUM globally, based on their definition of AUM, around 73% of that is in either private equity, private debt, or real estate. So clearly not a listed equity focused. And a Preqin report of 2024 takes up the second cliche, which is that impact investing is usually much less profitable than sustainable investing. And in fact, their numbers basically say that the average performance for impact investing was 7.4% compared to the 13.5% of a traditional sustainable or ESG investment fund. You seem to be taking things differently. Did I get the definition wrong? Or what is impact investing and how do you take it on?
That's a very good question. By the way, we are part of a GIN and we are also a member of the listed equities working group within the GIN. So this is like a topic and a discussion that has come up quite a few times over the last few years. First of all, obviously, if you want to transpose the rationale of impact investing into listed financial markets, you need to make some adjustments. That's no doubt about that. And the key adjustments are primarily focused on additionality, in the sense that it's very difficult to prove any kind of additionality in the listed bond space. But with respect to the other two key pillars of impact investing, which is like intentionality and measurability, I think that you can do a pretty good job on listed markets as well. This is the reason why in the design of our investment products, we have been focusing on intentionality and measurability, and specifically in defining ex ante the specific impact objectives that we want to pursue in the investment policy in order to make them binding, or as binding as are the financial limits that are traditionally enshrined within a given investment policy. It is absolutely true that impact investing was born and was genetically born into the private equity and venture capital space. But here there is like a provocative question, which is like, do we want to keep it like a niche investment approach, or do we want it to make it a systemic investment approach? I think that if we decide to adopt the most rigorous and most excluding definition of impact investing, it is true you may have like some impact funds which are struggling a bit quite often lately with respect to the fundraising. You're forcing financial markets or financial industry just to have available highly liquid products reserved just to institutional investors. But if we want to meet the capital deployment requirements that, for example, were defined with the SDGs, as far as they look now, I think that you need necessarily to involve listed markets, because it's where you find like assets under management on a different magnitude. It is like a 100 to 1 relationship, the relationship that between the asset under management in the private market world with respect to the listed market world. So is it easy to do so? No, not at all. Obviously, the impact intensity, so the amount of impact that you can achieve with any euro deployed, is different in the listed space with respect to the private market space. Does it mean that we need to not to find new ways to do that? I think that that's wrong. And I think that we definitely need to make impact investing an approach that can be applied across the board to any asset class, to any investment strategy, with different degrees of intensities. I think that is absolutely key. And I think that it is the only way to truly engage institutional investors on a large scale. And I think it's the only way to make impact-focused investment products available to retail investors as well. Because otherwise, if we want to stick to the rigorous definition, now I'm not saying that we need to dilute it. I just simply say that we need to be fully transparent of what can truly be achieved and what cannot be achieved. Like depending on whether on the specific investment strategy, you're applying an impact lens on. So the key is to move from, my opinion, impact investing as an asset class to impact investing as a systemic investment approach that can be applied across the spectrum to any investment strategy. One key provocation here. When you buy and sell, when you make a trade on listed equity space, you're buying a secondary position, right? So you're operating the secondary markets by definition. So there is no capital injection in the company whatsoever. Is it that different from with respect to a private equity impact focused firm buying a stake into an impact company on through a secondary round? Because also in that case, there is no capital injection. So if the entire discourse and an argument on additionality is based on capital injection, also quite a large share of the capital allocated to impact investment strategies in private markets could be subject to criticism, or at least to the same criticism. And the second point is that quite often, it is true that you have a lower return when you also optimize for the third dimension, which is not just risk to return, but a risk return and impact. It is true. It has been the case. In the listed capital market space, the space, like the room for giving up on returns is much more limited. For example, we cannot afford that. We are a financial first, impact focused investment management company. But I do believe, and it was also part of a very interesting discussion that we had, like when we met last time, we think that by applying a pragmatic impact lens, you can actually generate extremely competitive returns as long as you connect impact objectives to structural trends. Okay. And I think that right now we have been missing a bit. What is the best way to design impact investment products in the listed equity space? And also how to make it relevant regardless of the hype that ESG has or does not have in a given moment in time. Because like if an impact product works well just when there is like a good vibe around impact investing or about sustainable investing in general, then you'll have like a backlash also in terms of like a fundraising when the tide turns.
Look, there's a lot to unpack there. Maybe some quick follow-ups. First is you're almost challenging the definition of impact investing, or at least you're offering a broader perspective of that. Do you think the 1.3 trillion that the gin now defines the market is the right size if we take your approach? So in other words, I'm kind of guessworking here, but if you think a broader perspective, how big is and how big could be the impact investment approach given the view you or the perspective you're offering?
We are generally surveyed by the gene as well as member. So we explain in a very transparent way how we design our impact measurement management systems for our listed equity and listed bond strategies. I think that like we need to scale impact investing. What I know for sure is that we need to scale impact investing in order to try to achieve the key sustainability goals that are truly relevant, because in the end, in my opinion, it's a matter of living well on this planet in the future. In the sense, it's a matter of like keeping on living, it's a matter of survival to a large. So there are obviously some objectives that have a greater priority compared to others, in my opinion. So I simply see no way to do that without also started thinking of how to make the impact dimension relevant also in in a sovereign bond allocation by a very large pension fund. Why do pension funds have to think about impact investing only for like 0.5%, 1% of their entire asset allocation? This is wrong. This is not a right way to think in a time of like the existential challenges that we're facing. So I cannot tell you whether like the overall estimate is right or wrong. I think that like the methodology underpinning such estimate is sound enough. But the key is that like I'm definitely in favor of having impact investing transforming itself from like a niche asset class in its own to a systematic investment approach that can be applied across any kind of investment strategy.
So I'm thinking about the current ESG headwinds and the backlash, and this is all happening while at the same time, I think something like 60% of companies last year signaled that they had, at least in one of their operation, a climate impact on their work, on the way they're actually having and running their business. So are you saying in a way that there's a new paradigm in how we run investments in this post-ESG backlash world, where impact investing is almost like the answer to the new way of being a sustainable investment? And what does that look like?
The short answer is yes. And I'll go a bit further. ESG as a holistic approach, as a generalist approach to sustainability, measuring everything. And so ending up, in my opinion, measuring nothing is over. I have like this strong conviction that like ESG as a generalist approach to sustainability is over, and maybe it's over for the good, in the sense that this may create the space for a new discourse, for a new narrative, how we make sure that sustainability, the true sustainability, is here to transform the way our economies work, in spite of a specific hypes that this topic may have or may not have in financial markets that are, as we have been seeing, and we can say quite confidently now, quite changeable in their approach to specific themes and narratives that dominate, like in different periods of time, what the markets pay most attention to. My proposal would be to start to seeing at impact dimensions as the new way to purchase sustainability. So with an obviously an expertise that will need to become in sustainability, sustainable investment themes, much more thematic. I think that there is a huge opportunity here to reconfigure the paradigm towards like impact dimensions that are connected to geopolitical priorities on one side and structural trends on the other side. I'll give an example. Obviously, my key expertise is on climate finance, mitigation investments, and adaptation resilience investments. That is, like my opinion, the absolute key priority that we should have, because it's a matter of survival of humankind on this world, to get like the right capital deployment with respect to climate mitigation and climate adaptation.
Some people say we're over-hyping the risk. Is that true?
Let them see what will happen in the coming years. We have been, according to the latest scientific evidence, in spite of what like some may say in the US, we have been systematically underestimating physical risks in our modeling. So according to the latest scientific evidence, if you look at satellite observations from 2001 to 2023, and you try to fit them with the main climate models, you see that has been shown that the only climate models that could be considered as a good fit are the ones that consider a climate sensitivity, which is like how much temperature increase every doubling of CO2 concentration in the air, at least above 2.5 degrees. So it means that any climate model that has like a lower climate sensitivity is not consistent with satellite observations starting from 2001. What does it mean? Is that the scenario that we have started seeing now is the one that we would have expected in 2000, in the end of the 2030s, beginning 2040s. So we are running very, very fast towards a climate scenario that is extremely adverse. And we have been underestimating also the feedback loops in the systems, because like we do not truly know how the climate system works exactly. And we try to improve over time our understanding of it. In base, like the scientific community is trying to do so. Our role is to try to make that knowledge useful for capital allocation decisions. So to your point, I think that we are underestimating the greatest challenge of our time. And I think there will be a wake-up call in the coming years in face of an extreme hardship that we'll need to go through. And I hope from that kind of hardship, a new renaissance will come. But this is the way in which I see climate change. So, for example, that is key structural trends. But what is interesting right now, for example, talking about climate change and the mitigation side, is that if you take a look at how the energy transition is going in the real world, in the real economy, you see actually that there was no backlash. The trend is structural. And now, transition funds, for example, that have been among the best performers in the market since beginning of 2025, but like they are up by an average 32%. They have been outperforming other kind of strategies, also because they started to attract mandates that have nothing to do with any kind of integration of sustainability criteria, which is the right way to go, in my opinion. You need to set input objectives well in advance that are related to key structural trends that will end up attracting larger flows of capital because it's a structural trend. So with same thing, we could say for demography. Like, is like maybe we have someone out there, we don't know, that denies that we are in advanced countries. We are in a structural demographic decline. Maybe there's like someone that denies that in the same way in which like someone is denying climate change today, or is denying gravity as far as I'm concerned. But the point is that is a fact. And how many impact positive business models could arise from leverage the demographic trend that we know for a fact that will take place and will progress over the coming years. I think that is the right pragmatic way to think of impact investing. And by doing so, I think that we can generate competitive financial returns that eventually are key to make these approach to investment management truly sustainable on its own right from a financial perspective over time, because we need to connect that to geopolitical priorities and structural trends. On geopolitical priority, very briefly, Green Deal in European Union. Great. Okay. It led us to a bunch of like regulations, some of which are now being challenged. But was it right the way in which the Green Deal was pitched in the first time? Someone could argue yes, someone could argue no. I would argue it was definitely a good thing to do, but it has been sold very poorly, in the sense that the Green Deal is, first of all, a way to ensure energy affordability and energy price competitiveness for the benefits and interests of European Union. I'm talking from a European Union, not from European perspective, which is my perspective.
I mean, you're saying basically we didn't sell it to your citizen.
Yeah, the one in charge of selling it did a very poor job, because like, if you sell like the Green Deal or the Clean Industrial Deal as a way to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels, but not just for climate reasons, but also because in time of geopolitical rivalry, dependencies get may be transformed very rapidly into vulnerabilities. And therefore, by reducing our dependency on fossil fuel imports, we are protecting, we are enhancing our energy security, because like having solar PV, having wind energy, leaving aside for 1 second the fact that supply chains are like primarily controlled by China, but that's also part of the problem, because like if you think in terms like of strategic independence, for example, European Union level, you need to control also the key technologies for that given value chain that is key for your strategic independence objective. So, and the same thing like is true for economic competitiveness. You want to reduce energy prices in Europe. That's great. The best way to do is through PPAs that are based on clean tech. So clean, renewable energy capacity. Now, for example, like looking at the latest tenders of a battery storage, if you combine battery storage with solar PV, you get an average price of electricity, which is the most competitive one in many markets. Also compared to traditional fossil fuels or combined cycle gas turbine, for example. So, and by doing so, by selling the Green Deal, for example, in this way, like people also that are not interested in climate change, because they don't see the urgency, because they are not fully aware of the graveness of the challenge, but they see the opportunity to protect their own interests. They see the opportunity to ensure energy affordability, energy security going forward. And if you manage to do that, the impact objective that you pursue, that of like fighting against climate change, is aligned with the financial returns that may arise from protecting our own interests. I think that it'd be the key paradigm shift that we need to achieve in order to make sustainability as important as it tends to be if we want to survive well on this planet.
But there's something around the Green Deal which was around how to communicate it. And clearly I think you're flagging that we didn't flag it enough as an interest to your average citizen. But there's also then the implementation. And the implementation from a regulatory perspective has been often a bunch of disclosure regulations that have taken companies and investors a lot of time to respond to. Was that the right way forward? In other words, have regulation helped the journey that you're recommending or hampered it?
Very straightforwardly, any regulation related to sustainable finance that leads to compliance but does not lead to capital deployment is useless.
And what does that mean for what we've had? What's your assessment?
The assessment is that the intentions were good, and also some of the outcomes have been very good, because like the SFDR, for example, regulation in Europe has managed to change the narrative, to reframe the way in which sustainability is integrated into investing decision making. But the problem is that most of the requirements of the regulations, SFDR taxonomy, were centered on disclosure, on a type of disclosure that intrinsically relied on a huge information asymmetry between the producer of the information and the user of information. If you take a look at the periodic reporting of the SFDR, for example, and I've been working on that quite a lot lately, you have like a very technical information that you need to include, that you need to disclose, but sometimes we're not easy to understand even for portfolio managers working in the same company. Imagine how could a retail investor, an end investor, understand that? Like there were like tens of pages of like technical information, no specific sustainable sustainable performance indicator. It's very difficult for a retail investor to understand and to spend also like to pay enough attention to all the specific details And actually, the entire like SFDR was a, like it was sustainable finance disclosure requirement, because like was disclosure regulation, because it was primarily focused on disclosure for the end investors. They failed in best respect. Also because like quite often retail investors, they still have quite often some difficulties in understanding key financial aspects of a given investment product. Imagine like to understand like the complexity of like a broad set of sustainability indicators. So I think that the latest review, for example, is SFDR, has like some positive elements. For example, the most important one that I see is the labeling, in the, like is a categorization of investment products into formally defined investment categories. It is what the SFDR SFDR 1.0 has become, because there was like a vacuum of like investment category or predefined investment categories in the market.
Sorry, and given your view of systemic approach to impact, what would be the labels you would envision your sort of services and your sort of funds to go towards? Is it the more new basic level? Is it the more transition? Is it, you know, which one?
Actually, I'll draw upon the latest categorization of SFDR, the proposed one by SFDR 2.0. You have like transition funds, which was the missing category, obviously, sustainability integration funds, and sustainable objective funds, which are the current Article 9 funds. But there is also an additional category, which is like impact funds, could be applied to both the transition funds and the sustainable objective funds. What does it mean? That what becomes key is like the transparency in defining the impact objective that you pursue formally in the investment strategy, but you allow for impact objectives also being focused on performance improvement rather than like on reduction of negative impact, rather than exclusively focused on positive impacts. I'm saying probably something very controversial to most of the people that work in impact investing or like in sustainable investing generally. But like, in my opinion, if you define very precisely what's the negative impact that you're targeting, and you specifically define a theory of change through which that negative impact can be reduced over time, I think that collectively we need a lot of efforts to be put into reducing negative impacts, at least as much effort as we need for producing positive impact. So if this new impact fund category allows for having a transition fund that invests in companies that obviously by operating in listed capital markets, but tend to be very diversified with a lot of like different business models under the same umbrella, you have like a high degree of complexity in assessing the positive and negative impact of that company. And the only rationale that holds is a netting rationale, where you combine negative impacts with positive impacts based on the specific impact dimensions that you're targeting in your investment strategy. And then based on that, you make an assessment of the company. By doing so, I think that like if you leave space, but you're very rigorous in defining how that impact needs to be measured and what are specific impact objectives that need to be achieved at any point in time during the management of that given fund, I think that like applying the impact measurement and management rationale also to transition funds is absolutely key to accelerate the energy transition, which is an absolute priority for climate reasons, which I connect to survival reasons, to energy security reasons, and to energy affordability reasons. So why shouldn't we do that? This is like, for example, an approach that could make sense in terms like how we make impact relevant across the board. And I connect to the previous question that you asked, but like this could be a good way forward. But I also other elements of SFDR2 that like, they are not great. We are still talking about like a period in which like there is a backtrack on like key regulation that instead would have increased the degree of transparency of information availability in the market. I'm talking about CSRD that is being downscaled, or like CSDDD that is getting devoided of its meaning. Looking at the glass half hand, but half full, I think that like this approach to impact fund could be a good way forward.
But under regulation is a mixed bag. I'm hearing some have worked, some have not. Look, I want to go back to this different way of being a sustainable / impact investor that you're proposing. You know, this systemic theme-based that responds to macroeconomic and geopolitical trends. How does an investor do this? I mean, practically, are the toolings and the approaches that we've had till now the same, but it's a different way to look at it? Or do we also need to change that? What's the day-to-day?
The day-to-day, in my opinion, is linked to a cultural paradigm shift in the sustainable investing world. We live in very interesting and challenging times, where the meaning of like sustainability is being challenged, because now we have been seeing that since the beginning of 2025, now the aerospace and defense, like investing weapons, has become a key trend of sustainable investment products.
Is that right?
My opinion, no. But not because I'm against investing in security. We obviously need to enhance our deterrence, particularly here in Europe, considering like the geopolitical landscape that is getting reshaped. But we need to invest into defense. We need to invest into aerospace. Obviously, this is a key technological lever also for future economic growth. We need to invest in deterrence, but why do we have to call it sustainable? I truly don't get that. We need to invest that, but don't call it sustainable, because like it is inconsistent at any level with the definition of sustainability that we have been given ourselves, the scientific one, like the formal one. So if we want to launch new investment products focused on defense or with a strong tilt towards like the defense investments, absolutely, we need to do that. We need to invest in defense smart, because like if each country gets rearmed without a common coordination and a common framework, for example, in the European Union, that is a recipe for a disaster, not for a common defense. But we need common defense. Not like a nationalist race to rearm, because like in the past, that was like the canary in the coal mine for tragedies on a global scale.
But going back to that, what is the day to day, right?
Yeah, the day to day is like, first of all, you need like a cultural shift, and a one that like moves from a generalist approach. So you need to access like a thematic expertise on the verticals you want to focus on. For example, you identify key themes. Adaptation resilience is my key theme. Mitigate decarbonization, electrification, biodiversity, circular economy, water tech, and you hire expertise with this thematic approach. Once you have done that, you start defining the specific ways in which across your investment strategies, you can apply this expertise in order to generate financial returns. You then try to understand how the frameworks that arise from these key thematic expertise can be made relevant for identifying target investments in light of the specific financial and impact objectives that you formally define in each of the products, with different degrees of impact intensity based on the specific investment strategy that you have. But it's like, I would say, the key operational elements on a day-to-day basis in order to shift towards this new approach. And one key point, this is an innovation, my opinion, that we have brought into the way in which we deploy capital at Impact, is that you need to define investment, not only investment level limits that are related to impact indicators, but also portfolio level limits that are exposure based, linked to specific impact indicators, in exactly the same way in which we do that, and we have been doing that for decades, regarding as to financial indicators. I'll give you an example. You have, like, if you have a balanced investment strategy with 70% bond, 30% equity, you have those investment portfolio level limits that are, like, formally binding, and if you breach them, you get sanctioned. We have applied the same rationale, the same approach, also with respect to impact clinics. For example, in our Article 9 funds, any of our Article 9 funds need to have at least 10% of taxonomy alignment to the climate objectives, which means that we need to have, like, a software application allowing us to measure and manage impact on a continuous basis, because, like, valuations of our investments change on a daily basis in multiple times per day in the listed equity space. So you need to have software dedicated to a specific task. This is, like, a way in which, on a daily basis, I think you can try to change the approach from a generalist ESG approach to an approach based on specific impact dimensions that connect to structural trends and geopolitical objectives.
And, you know, how do you see the use of, you know, ratings, data, information change as you look at this approach? Is that the same or different?
In my opinion, it's different in the sense that you need to pick the specific metrics and indicators that are relevant for the pursuit of your specific impact objectives that you have formally defined in investment strategies. Like, our impact positioning was born out of a criticism of ESG. I stick to that in the sense that you need to have, like, a specific set of, or possibly standardized, metrics and indicators, but standardized with respect to that specific input objective, not that have the overall goal of measuring the sustainability performance in general of a given company. Also because, like, in my opinion, is quite often an apple-to-pear comparison rather than an apple-to-apple comparison.
Good. Well, look, maybe how do you see AI and technology come into this? Is it both from an investment process perspective as well as an investment opportunity or risk? Is this a net positive, a net negative? How do you guys see it in your approach?
First of all, the way in which we have been gaining exposure to AI is through the energy angle, the clean energy angle, because we see the power needs that are implicit in the current trajectory of AI development as a key structural trends, with the electricity demand having started to rise again also in all advanced countries after decades of stagnation, as a key indicator of the huge power needs that we have and that we'll increasingly have. So we have been gaining exposure to the AI theme from this perspective, and also from the water tech angle, because, like, probably the greatest constraint to a large-scale deployment of AI capability is water. Access to water. And then the third theme has been cooling, like cooling technologies. We'll need huge cooling tech being deployed in order to move from, like, data centers with pods that are in the range of 40 kilowatts to 140 kilowatts per pod. Having said that, I think that, like, AI valuations are extremely stretched right now. I do agree with some of the articles that I read lately, which see a parallelism between the infrastructure building of AI data center today and railway networks at the end of the 19th century. In the sense that, quite obviously, valuations will be corrected at some point in time into the future, but the infrastructure is here to stay. So even if the companies that now are building it won't be the same ones that will be profiting from it, I think the key data center infrastructure that we have started building now for large-scale AI application deployment, I think that will be transformational. Transformational for the good or for the bad? Well, what I can see from now, from my perspective today, is that it will be one of the most powerful technologies ever invented. And as always, it will come down to human intentionality. How good, how bad, how smart, or how not smart we are. Some good reasons to think today that we are not that smart. But I think that AI could be a net positive, a huge net positive in the future, as long as we check and balance the huge potential negative impacts in terms of like of cybersecurity, cyber attacks, increasing the quality that could arise from AI.
Larry, we're running a bit out of time, but I will maybe try to get squeeze in a couple of questions just briefly.
Yeah, sure.
The first is to finish the AI piece. Does it matter, or is it helping or making life harder for you as an investor today? Are you using AI?
We definitely use AI. We have started doing that for a variety of different tasks. What I can see is that where human supervision and human input is crucial and will remain crucial in the foreseeable future, that you need to control the sources, no doubt about that. And you need to define the narrative, the storytelling, the methodological framework that you want to implement for a given investment decision-making process. Once that you have defined and you control those elements, leveraging AI, potential super leverage for increasing productivity, but the sources and the targets and the frameworks for achieving those targets need to be controlled by humans. And it is what we have. This is the approach that I adopted in my team, and we have been adopting across our company.
Great. Look, I think you know that we have this thing where we ask every guest, what is their sustainability art piece that they are particularly attached to, and share it with us? So I don't know if you had a chance to think about it.
Yes, that was a very interesting question, and I have two. One is the front cover of the New Yorker of November 15, 2021, where you see Don Quixote on a white horse at the foot of like huge wind turbines with a burning city in the background. I think that is like a quite epic representation of the challenge and a huge challenge that we are facing and the reason why we need to deploy climate finance, both in terms of mitigation and adaptation investments, as fast as possible. And I love that cover, and I do like the New Yorker quite a lot as well. And the second one is a more classical one, which is The Garden of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch, where you have a representation of like paradise, purgatory, and hell. And I think it was also the painting that was used as a metaphor in the movie, in the documentary by Leonardo DiCaprio on Before the Floods. And I do see where we should, aim for, which is like trying to stay attached to the best of our capabilities and energy to the paradise version of that painting, and fight as hard as we can against sliding towards the hell version of it.
Great. And look, before we close, there's a few quick fire questions that we always like to ask our guests. So, and I'll probably pick a couple from the things that I think we didn't finish discussing in our chat. So I'll start from AI, net positive or net negative?
I tend to be quite optimistic, net positive.
And ESG ratings, in or out?
Out.
And if you had to pick one myth around sustainable investments to drop immediately, what would it be?
That compliance leads to capital deployment.
Great. And is there a theme in sustainability that is overhyped?
I think there are quite a few. I think the main one right now is defense, I think.
A sector that you think is mispriced for physical climate risk today?
I got two, insurance and real estate.
Great. And maybe one last thing. If the future sustainable investment was a fruit or a vegetable, which one would it be?
Fruit or veggie, thought about that, not sure. Olive tree. And because it is been around for, like, there are olive trees that have been alive for thousands of years. And as my focus on adaptation and resilience finance imposes, I think that we should take them as an example and as a way of trying to survive well and adapt in a rapidly changing world.
Well, look, I think we need to close, but I've taken away a lot of interesting thoughts. Maybe at the very top level, it's really around how impact investment might be the systemic investment drive that a lot of asset owners are now calling for. And so how those 1.2 trillion could become a much larger size of the sustainable investment universe. And that we're in a world that is a bit of a disaster economy, as you mentioned to me when we met. I don't know if you've seen it, Dario, but there's this series called Extrapolation, which is basically, it's a great series that shows how in the next 20, 30, up to 100 years, our world will be impacted by climate. And it's based on science data. But a lot of people that watch this series will say it looks like science fiction. And the response of the writer of the show is anyone that depicts the future not this way is actually writing science fiction. So I think if we are investors and we need to think of how we operate, we need to adjust to the reality of what, unfortunately, the future is looking like. And coming out of COP30 myself in Belém, I see that the decisions are not happening fast enough to slow things down. So I think your call to think of themes that will address how do we invest in a world that's different from the one that we have today, I think is a very great call for the investment community. So look, thank you, Dario, for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation. And I'll be happy to have another entire discussion on disaster economy that we discussed last time. I think that would be another very interesting discussion to have. But thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And really, thanks also for Luca Testonio was at the Cerrone SRI that helped us reconnect. Thanks to Curtis File, who produces the show along with Earworm. And if you liked this episode today, please like, subscribe, and comment. We would love to hear your views. And we hope to see you in the next episode soon. And until then, stay wired.